Sex galore, but no more marriages. No one pushing baby carriages. No one has to change a nappy. Ain't we lucky, oh, ain't we happy? Everybody's happy now. Oh, dope for tea and dope for dinner. Fun all night and love and laughter. No remorse the morning after. Where's the sin and who's the sinner? Everybody's happy now. Girls pneumatic, girls exotic, girls ecstatic, girls erotic. Hug me, baby, make it snappy. Everybody's oh so happy. Everybody's happy now. Lots to eat and hours for drinking. So more cocktails and no more thinking. No more thinking. No more thinking. Oh, everybody's happy now.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Gnostic Media Radio Show. I'm your host, Jan Ervin, GnosticMedia.com, G-N-O-S. TICmedia.com, and I've got a couple of updates here. Lark had an emergency. Apparently, he wasn't able to make it last night. He was supposed to come on tonight with me to discuss communitarianism, and of course, he hosts the show on Wednesday and every other Thursday. And so, anyway, apparently, he is in the hospital. So. So that's that. I don't want to give out too much. I don't know too much information about it. So we'll let people know more as we find out. And also today, Target stores announced that they're getting rid of gender segregation in the toy and clothing sections. And, of course, we've been exposing all of the destruction of gender and the family and everything else. This is a part of it. This is their promotion of all the, the phytoestrogens in the water and in the plastics and in the drugs and chemicals and everything else, which I've discussed with Curtis Duncan. We'll have to have him come back on and do another show about all of this as well. But personally, I find it rather disgusting, and I think people should consider writing Target corporate headquarters and voicing their opinion about it, and not only that, but boycotting them with your dollars. And tonight, I'm going to be rejoined by David Livingstone. We're going to be discussing the Sebastian Jews and some other good material, and this was the last second, and I really appreciate David for coming on at such short notice, because I only found out that Lark was in the hospital exactly an hour ago. So anyway, David, welcome back to the show.
Good. Thanks. Nice to be back. Thanks, yeah.
You're welcome. Glad to have you back. So you want to dig right in?
Let's do it.
All right. Why don't we start off, where's a good starting point with this subject? Should we start off by Sabbatai Zevi, I guess?
Well, what I was thinking was to put it in perspective first.
Sure.
Because it actually ties into transhumanism indirectly.
Okay. Well, that works perfectly then.
Yeah. So transhumanism and the New Age movement, as almost every occult sort of philosophy in the last 1,000 years or so, has been millenarian. Right? So the singularity is basically sort of a millenarian scenario. It's like a sort of an apocalyptic scenario. And so, as is the New Age, the whole idea of a dawning of a New Age, it's non-Christian, so people can't see it as being similar to sort of more classical millenarian ideas, but it's rooted in the same, and that really originally derives from Sabbatianism. And in fact, it actually dates back a little earlier. One of the most Well, Jacob Boehmer is a very key influence, but as was Joachim of Fiore. He was one of the, really one of the first, as I understand it, to expound on a an elaborate millenarian scenario. If anybody doesn't know what millenarium is, is basically it's prophecies about the end times, and you know, usually they're understood to be negative in a sort of apocalyptic sense, but for occultists, it's in a positive sense. So even though the New Age is basically anti-Christian, it's actually derived from a, if I may say so, Gnostic interpretation of Christianity, as is the singularity. So basically, the most important millenarian tradition is Rosicrucianism, and transhumanism is Rosicrucianism. So even if you read Nick Bostrom's book, The History of Transhumanism, he doesn't come out and say it, but it's obvious by the people that he lists all the various figures in history who have been key to the development of Rosicrucianism. So to get back to Sabbatianism, it was the Rosicrucians who were responsible for the creation of that movement. So this is a unique theory. It's not one that I've seen expounded on by anybody else, but this is what I've discovered from my research and what I try to expose in my book, Black Terror, White Soldiers. So we can get into that unless you have any other questions.
Sure. Well, I've got a few questions here, but if you'd like to just go into your book, that's fine as well. I can ditch my partial outline here.
Okay. So the Sabbatian movement begins with Sabbatai Zvi, who announced himself as the Messiah of the Jews in 1666. This was an enormously important event in Jewish history. By most estimates, half the world's Jewish population at the time believed in his mission. I think it's important first to clear some prejudices because you know, people in the West are under the impression that most history took place in Europe. But the fact is that Europe was actually of a rather minority influence during those times. We're talking about a Jewish population that was spread throughout the world, with many influential centers, mainly in Egypt, North Africa, and of course Iran, most parts of the Middle East, Turkey, and so on and so forth. So the news spread fairly quickly. This happened in Turkey at the time, basically within the Ottoman Empire. The news basically was... it caught on like wildfire. It caused a lot of excitement, but eventually Sabbatai Zvi decided to basically feign a conversion to Islam. And this was a decision. What happened then was that there was immense disappointment. People, basically it's referred to as his apostasy. So most of the enthusiasm for his mission died down, but there was still a significant number of his core followers continued to believe in his mission, and they believed that his conversion to Islam was an important mystery, or you know, as basically an esoteric aspect of his mission. So what I showed in my book is that, and this is a book. The whole idea of millenarianism is a topic that has been extensively studied by Richard Popkin. This is a guy that you've referred to in your articles. He also happens to be responsible for the book that discussed the idea of Oswald having a double. But otherwise, he's a scholar of some renown, and his specialty is millenarianism. So the strange thing is that he connects all the dots are there in his book, but he doesn't connect them. And so it was by doing a little bit more research that I was able to recognize the significance of the people he was naming. So what happens at the turn of the early 17th century, so the early 1600s, is you have this group of Puritan and English philosophers who were basically Popkins refers to as millenarians. They were developing these ideas about the coming of the Messiah and various scenarios for the end time. And they were based around a rabbi of Amsterdam named Manasseh ben Israel. And what's interesting is that Manasseh ben Israel, this is at a time now we're talking, I mean, first of all, in Europe, Jews had been kicked out of most countries of Europe. This has started sometime in the early 1300s. In fact, the first expulsion was from England itself, which I think took place in 1290 something. And it was only a few years after that that the Templars were disbanded. And then within only a few years after the Templars being disbanded, the Jews then were kicked out of most countries in Europe, France, Germany, basically most countries in Europe. So Manasseh ben Israel, who was based in Amsterdam, which is a very important center of Morano Jews. So we have to remember that the context here is that the Jews were suffering persecution in Spain. So both Muslims and Jews were forced to convert to Christianity or expelled from the country. So many of them left, but those who chose to convert among the Jews converted outwardly to Christianity, but continued to practice Judaism secretly. This is a very important period in Jewish history, and they became known from then on as Moranos or as conversos. So a lot of Jews fled Spain and established themselves in various other parts of the world. One very important place where they established themselves a few centuries earlier was in Italy, and it was their introduction of Kabbalistic influence, which basically resulted in the Renaissance. So coincidentally, we have what's called the High Renaissance, which takes place in Holland. And that again coincides with the influx of Kabbalistic Jews in that country. So Manasseh ben Israel was pretty much the leader of this community. They, of course, were a very influential, financially influential community. So Manasseh ben Israel, he teamed up with Oliver Cromwell, and he funded Cromwell to overthrow Charles I. So for those who are not familiar with this history, Charles I was overthrown by Cromwell and eventually executed. And Cromwell basically took over the country for a period of time. When that happened, the deal was that Cromwell would receive funding and in return, he would repeal the law that forbade Jews from entering England. So, in fact, we talked about Marcia Keith Schuchard, I think, on the last show. She's the writer of the book on Swedenborg.
Okay, yes, we did.
And she's also written a book on Restoring the Temple Vision, which is really probably the most important book in our time, I think, on that coincidentally, not only on Freemasonry, but on Sabbatianism. So she shows that Cromwell's network, himself and his entire network, were Rosicrucians, were referred to as Rosicrucians even. So out of this network, now the circle around Manasseh ben Israel, there's a couple of key characters. The main three that I'll mention, one is John Dury, Samuel Hartlib, and Comenius. Comenius, I think, was established in Germany before connecting with Samuel Hartley. John Dury was in England. So this group basically created an international network. They called it, referred to them as intelligencers, in fact. So that's why they're called, referred to as the Hartlib Circle. And this network were effectively they were Rosicrucians or connected to the Rosicrucian movement. And basically, eventually, it's out of the hot club circle that you get the Invisible College. And the Invisible College, of course, is named after the similar society that's mentioned in Francis Bacon's The New Atlantis. So as I said, these guys, particularly John Dewey in England, they were part of a network of what are referred to as millenarians. They were starting to build up this expectation for the coming of the Messiah, which they were predicting, not coincidentally, in 1666. So eventually in 1666, when Sabbaté Zévi announces his messiahship, the news is basically spread by the people who are involved in the Rosicrucian movement. The most important character is a guy named Peter Serrarius, and he was a guy then who was connected with Manasseh ben Israel, the Hartleb Circle, and so on and so forth, and primarily the guy who was responsible for communicating news about Zabi's mission to the Jews of Amsterdam. So that's how I conclude that obviously it was the Rosicrucians who were responsible effectively for orchestrating Sabbaté Zévi's mission. So because the influence there happens in multiple directions. So first of all, Sabbaté Zévi, in fact, according to Gershom Scholem, Zévi's mission was very much a reaction to the Inquisition. So the Inquisition, argues Scholem, was, you know, really induced a certain kind of trauma on the worldwide Jewish community. And so this is why, in a lot of ways, they were able to accept Zévi's conversion to Islam, because this was an experience that was important already to the Jewish community. But before that, Sabbaté Zévi was really a representative of the Kabbalah of Isaac Luria. And so Isaac Luria was a rabbi based in Palestine who is considered the father of what's called the New Kabbalah. And so he introduced, to make a long story short, the idea that he introduced was that it was that man, that when God created man, he created an other of himself. So in the beginning, this other, which is man, doesn't know that he is God. So human history is the evolution of man coming to know that he is God. So this is why the ultimate, and I mean, there, first of all, that's the basis of the theory of evolution and ultimately of transhumanism. So that's how it's all connected, because it's always been basically New Kabbalah or Lurianic Kabbalah.
Right.
Hegel as well is based on Lurianic Kabbalah, or more specifically Jacob Burma, because Jacob Burma was based on the Lurianic Kabbalah. The person through which these ideas were communicated was a guy named Balthasar Walter, who was a German Jew who traveled to Palestine to study with the students of Isaac Luria, and he communicated Luria's ideas to Jacob Burma. So that's how Burma basically, you know, almost directly Christianized. You know, really, when we say Christianized, they're not Christians. By giving a Christian guise to these ideas, this is how they were able to hide the fact that they are basically, you know, secretly Kabbalistic Jews, pretty much. So, sorry, I haven't heard that. Because, you know, this wasn't in my plans tonight.
Right. Well, that's a commercial break, so we'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Perfect timing.
Indeed. Thanks, John. Yep. We're back. Well, Boy, you know, we talked about that book regarding Emanuel Swedenborg, Secret Agent on Earth and in Heaven, Jacobites, Jews, and the Freemasons in Early Modern Sweden. And the sucker is $247. You got it through interlibrary loan. But, you know, if anybody out there is willing to donate a copy of that to Gnostic Media, I'd surely appreciate it. And it's by Marsha Shukard, something like that. Yeah. Anyway, so you and I were discussing, Sebastian Jews, the origins of that. You discussed Sabbatai Levi and his conversion to Islam. What about Hasidic Jews? Do they also stem out of Sebastian Jews?
Yeah, they do. It's one of the main important branches. There's a number of branches. There's an excellent book on this. The books to read would be To Eliminate the Opiate by Rabbi Alterman. And so there are two volumes. Basically, just to go back quickly, if you don't mind, is to how Sabbatianism evolved. As I said, Jacob Burma was the key agent. Through his mentor, was Balthazar Walter, who was a direct student of the students of Isaac Luria in Palestine. And from him, I mean, Jacob Burma was enormously influential. So he was the main influence behind the Martinists, by Saint Martin in particular, founder of the Martinists, also of Hegel. The book to read on that is Glenn Alexander McGee, which is Hegel and the Hermetic Tradition. There's no overt clue that Hegel was a member of the Illuminati, but there's enough incidental clues to show that he likely was. And definitely his entire philosophy of history is basically just a Christianized version of the evolution theory of Isaac Luria. And with Hegel there, I mean, that's it. That's really, essentially, when I was in university, what I was told, and I went to an Illuminati college in Montreal. I didn't know it at the time, of course, but I was told that Hegel was the greatest philosopher in history. So, really, at least in modern history. So Hegel has completely transformed our entire notion of history in particular. So the entire concept of Western history itself is a Hegelian interpretation of history, which again is all Lurianic Kabbalah. Because we need to talk about the influence of Sabbatianism. So basically, what Rabbi Eintelman shows is that the Rothschilds were a Sabbatian family and basically funded the Illuminati. So Illuminati was essentially a Sabbatian project. What's important is that, so Sabbatai Levi, his mission started, or he announces messiahship in 1666, but about 100 years later, who was supposed to be his successor was Jacob Frank, and who claimed to be a reincarnation of Sabbatai Levi, and taught basically the same thing. The basis of their teaching is the idea that with the coming of the Messiah, the laws of the Torah no longer apply. So they follow the Zohar only and reject the Bible, and they actually turn the Bible upside down. So basically it's a Gnostic interpretation of the Bible, and teaches that the prohibitions are now commandments, and the commandments are what's referred to as the holiness of sin. So they deliberately try to overturn the prohibitions of the Bible. So what they were particularly known for were sexual orgies, wife swapping, incest, and so on and so forth. We particularly see those trends evident in people like Freud, most importantly, and that's how those ideas got communicated through the Frankfurt School, through much of modern culture. So with Jacob Frank, his successor was his cousin, whose name was Moses Dobruska. And Moses Dobruska, he was the grand master and founder of what's called the Asiatic Brethren. So the Asiatic Brethren is a reference to Rosicrucian legend.
Everybody
because we're having a break again.
Yeah, hold that thought, and we'll be right back.
Lots to eat and hours for drinking. So more cocktails and no more thinking. No more thinking. No more thinking. Oh, everybody's happy now.
Back. Oh boy. So much to discuss here. This is a good topic. We're discussing Sebastianism, however you pronounce it. Anyway, here with David Livingston, and your website is conspiracyschool.com. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, where were we before we were so rudely interrupted by the advertisers paying for the show?
Exactly. I was explaining the Asiatic Brethren as being founded on a Rosicrucian legend. So, as you know, the story of Rosicrucian itself is based on the legend of a supposed mystic named Christian Rosenkreutz, who traveled throughout the Middle East and then returned with his mystical knowledge back to Germany. But there's another Kabbalistic legend, Rosicrucian legend, which claims that sometime after the time of Christ, that there was an Egyptian mystic who converted to Christianity. So basically what the suggestion is that he introduced Hermeticism into his Gnostic interpretation of Christianity, and that Gnostic Hermetic tradition survived until the time of the Templars. The Templars, by coming into contact with the Assassins, learned these ideas, and then they supposedly actually rescued a number of what they call these Assassins, they're identified with various sort of mystical Islamic traditions. So usually the Assassins, or the Ismailis, or the Sabians. But the fact is that the Assassins and Ismailis were all originally influenced by the Sabians anyway. So cryptically, these are referred to in Rosicrucian or Masonic tradition as Eastern mystics. And apparently, the Templars rescued a number of them and brought them to Scotland, so that's how you have the origin myth of what is called Scottish Rite Freemasonry. So when Jacob Frank's I was saying that Jacob Frank, who was the successor of Days of E, his own successor was his cousin named Moses Dobruska. When he founded the so-called Asiatic Brethren, it was in reference to these Eastern mystics of Rosicrucianism. So this was a pretty important secret society. Another Grand Master was a Prince Charles of Hessen-Kassel, and the Hessen-Kassel family was where the Rothschilds got their start, particularly with Charles's father. His brother, Frederick, was also pretty influential. Prince Charles also hosted Saint-Germain at his house, if you remember the Count of Saint-Germain. Does that sound familiar?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right. Count of Saint-Germain was enormously influential. I mean, even to this day, he's considered like a sort of messiah figure in a New Age movement because he was supposed to turn lead into gold. He had some mysterious source for his wealth. He could speak many languages. He seemed to be able to live forever, and so on and so forth. There's all kinds of legends that are attributed. There's a couple of directions I could go here.
Well, you know, why don't we dig into the alchemical aspect, and then it appears from alchemy that they are using that not really to convert lead into gold, but to convert society into whatever they want. Is that where you were going?
Well, actually, no. I was sticking more to the story.
All right.
The Count Saint-Germain, he was associated with another person who was very much like him, the Count Cagliostro. And Cagliostro was a student of Samuel Fulk, So Rabbi Samuel Falk, he was known as the Baal Shem of London. He was enormously influential, a black magician as well, and a Sabbatean. So he basically, Samuel Falk connected this entire network of occultists and Frankists and Sabbateans, and he was a mentor, so not only to Count Cagliostro, but also to Saint Martin, who was the founder of Martinism. And Martinism is a very important occult tradition. It's what evolves into Synarchism in the 20th century. And the other one is Swedenborg. So one reason why Shushard's book on Swedenborg is really important is for how she details and exposes the numerous Sabbatean connections that in Sweden, and of all places, that Swedenborg emerged from. So this is really the network where, you know, the most important occult trends that evolved in the 20th century begin to develop. The Asiatic Brethren in particular is very important. So there's two societies. Out of the Asiatic Brethren, you also, well, we're connected to them, is the English Rosicrucians. And the key character here is a guy named Edward Bulwer Lytton, who's really, you know, the grandmaster of the Rosicrucians, which really represents sort of a melding of all these traditions, as well as the Asiatic Brethren. So out of that, all of that sort of soup comes the Golden Dawn. And of course, out of the Golden Dawn, you get Aleister Crowley, and from Aleister Crowley, the OTO, and pretty much the rest is history. Where were we going from there? In Swedenborg.
Well, you were discussing Swedenborg. So he was influenced by Cagliostro.
We were talking about basically the you mentioned the Hasidism.
Right.
So now to backtrack a little bit, in the middle 18th century, so first of all, we have to understand that the Sabbateans reject Judaism. They reject the Bible. So they basically came in conflict with traditional Jews who were Bible, God-worshipping, Bible-believing Jews, or what came to be referred to as Orthodox Jews. So I mean, this is really important. This is really what Rabbi Antheman helps to point out, is to show that basically what we're talking about here, you know, and the fact is, I think what happens is that the real problem is that in this century, what has happened is that Jews are identified as a race. But this is a new idea, and that's an idea which is a Zionist idea, primarily attributable to Sabbateanism. Because
right, didn't that come around in the 16th or 17th centuries, the idea of a Jewish race?
No. This is what's important. It really starts with Moses Mendelssohn. So Moses Mendelssohn, who, this is what Rabbi Antheman shows, is that the secret document was found, which I think was into the possession of Jacob Schiff, which is interesting. Jacob Schiff, basically Rothschild agent, long time from a family that had a long-term relationship with the Rothschild. So this document was basically what's referred to as a list of ordination. So it's a secret list of the successors of Sabbatai Zvi. And there's a number of them. So it basically starts with Zvi. It includes Jacob Frank. It includes a very important rabbi named Rabbi Abashitz. I won't go into details there. But the other person on the list is Moses Mendelssohn, and who was enormously influential. He also had numerous Illuminati connections. So Moses Mendelssohn is considered the founder of Jewish secularism. So what happens is that for hundreds of years, Jews were living separate in ghettos, in basically following their own traditions and a distinct culture. With Mendelssohn, you get this new agenda or project, which is basically assimilationism. The idea of the secular Jews is that Jews shouldn't be distinct from the rest of society, but that they should try to assimilate and, you know, basically mirror the culture of the Europeans around them. This is an idea that could only be followed by people who rejected the religious basis of Judaism. So what happens is you get this enormous conflict. In fact, the conflict was already taking place. You know, Jacob Frank was excommunicated, which is why he converted to Christianity in the first place. He basically did the same thing that that Zavi did with Islam. He converted Christianity, as did most of his followers, and only really to use Christianity as a front to work. And really what their project is, and you know, this, I'm not telling you, this is not my own opinion. Again, this has basically been articulated by Gershom Scholem, that their project was to undermine and destroy every religion, which obviously is what the purpose of the Illuminati was. So there was a lot of conflict between the traditional Jewish community and the Sabbateans. They were repeated attempts to suppress them. They were excommunicated. And that's the thing, is that in those days, you could be excommunicated from Judaism, as, of course, you could convert to Judaism because it was a religion.
Yeah, not a race, right?
Not a race, right? So what happens is that it's the secular Jews who invented the term Orthodox Jews to suggest that they were just a branch of the Jewish people, when nothing was ever like that. It was never considered like that. It was always considered a religion. So by basically, you know, labeling Bible-believing Jews as a type of Jew, they were basically able to sort of legitimize other types of Jews as being part of the same Jewish community, particularly giving acceptance to the Sabbateans. So as Rabbi Antelman shows, that there's a number of traditions that the Jews were responsible for. Basically, they came in from all fronts and developed these various reform movements to basically hijack the Jewish religion and community. So what Gershom Scholem shows, this is another tangent, but Gershom Scholem shows that that Hasidism evolves from Sabbateanism. But Rabbi Antelman shows that there's three important traditions that emerge from Sabbateanism. So there's Reform Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, and the B'nai B'rith, which is basically a Masonic organization. And what's curious about Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism, so Reform Judaism basically is an attempt to basically sort of secularize Judaism, whereas Conservative Judaism, they made it seem like they were returning to the Bible, but the way that they argued it was that as history changes, man is allowed to reinterpret the Bible according to the situation. So basically, you know, you might as well throw the Bible in the garbage, because at that point, they could just say whatever they want. So right. what's happened now is effectively that, these two traditions are the dominant religious traditions in the United States, really showing to what extent Sabbateans have. Well, I mean, they've had the money behind them, right? So if you look at the major banking families, particularly the Rothschilds, they've had plenty of funding to assist them. And then since then, of course, Orthodox Jews have been significantly marginalized. They're quite a minority now. They're a minority in the United States. They are still fairly substantial in Britain. But what's particularly interesting is that they were the majority of the victims of the Holocaust.
Well, and that's a whole other topic too, but what do you think about guys like Rabbi Yisrael David Weiss from Naturi Karta out in New York? You know, he gets beat up pretty regularly, and I had him on my show about 5 years ago, but he gets beat up pretty regularly by other Jews for speaking out against Zionism, and he calls all of this stuff going on fake Judaism.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it is. So, you know, I haven't followed him that closely, but there's a few Orthodox Jews.
He's the one who, in New York, when President Ahmadinejad of Iran was in New York, they met, and Rabbi Weiss awarded Ahmadinejad for his humanitarian work and for supporting getting the truth out about Orthodox Jewry and everything else.
Yeah. No, I mean that's the thing, is that Orthodox Judaism is opposed fundamentally to Zionism, because it's not justified by traditional Judaism, because Zionism is not a religious idea. It's a secular idea. It's a nationalistic idea. It's just an idea that was the identity of the Jews to give it a religious veneer and convince, to fool the rest of the community to think that it has something to do, you know, even remotely.
It's almost like a form of, I hate to say this, a form of Satanism, Sebastian Judaism, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, Kabbalah is the Kabbalah itself is Luciferianism, always has been. Yeah, that's okay. What I show in my first book, The Dying God, is that the Kabbalah evolves as an adaptation or co-optation of the worship of the ancient worship of the dying God. Because, you know, in ancient Israel, we imagine that it would have been basically a population of Israelites, so there would have been some semblance of Judaism practice at the time. But the Judaism was almost non-existent in ancient Israel. You know, the Bible says how that there, you know, that foreign cults were practiced right inside the temple itself. Right? If there was any actual Judaism, the Judaism was practiced by the few reformers who came along, you know, every once in a while that tried to return the community back to the true teaching. But for the most part, they were practicing the worship of Baal and Astarte. Then these were the god and goddess of the Canaanites. But basically, Baal, how you pronounce him, is the devil, is Lucifer, is God of the underworld. And that's why the dying God he's the same deity that's worshipped throughout the ancient Middle East, just under a different name. So, and of course, this is how the Masons refer to it today.
So basically what they're doing, it appears to me, is reverse engineering the Bible to destroy society, and then essentially by claiming that they're God, and it sounds like we're ready to go to break, claiming that they're God, they then have to take ownership of everything, GMO foods, patenting everything out in life, so that they are the owners and controllers, and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
All right, we're back. You know, I wanted to tell a story when I was in the airport in New Jersey at the beginning of the year. I was out there at Princeton doing some research. As I was leaving, I was actually in the Newark airport getting on the plane, and this Hasidic Jew is being pushed through the airport in a wheelchair. And he gets pushed up to the same gate I'm going on to. And I think to myself, you know what? This guy's not handicapped. I go around and I take a look at his shoes and whatnot. And I'm just thinking to myself, this guy's not handicapped. He's taking advantage. Watch, they're going to push him on the airplane first, et cetera, which is exactly what they did. He got onto the airplane first. And then during the flight, he's sat about maybe five or six rows in front of me. And during the flight, right after the airplane took off and they took the seatbelt sign off, he was up and walking around the airplane. And he walked around the airplane for, you know, probably a good half hour, 40 minutes. So, you know, I mean, it's just any advantage that they can take, these Kabbalists, Luciferianists, Satanists, and we were discussing before the break that that's essentially what Sebastian Judaism and Hasidic Judaism, et cetera, is, and we also discussed Orthodox Judaism and how they're trying to fight it, that this is a false Messiah, etc. Zabbatai Levi, however you pronounce his name.
Zvi.
Right, and Zvi. And so, you know, they're essentially, the project seems to me to essentially create through the art of man copyrights and laws and everything that they can take false ownership of the creation of quote-unquote God or nature, and then put it under total control of themselves so that they have total ownership of the world.
Well, I mean, again, this goes back to transhumanism, right? Because what their goal is a bastardized Luciferian version of the Bible story. So they're expecting their Messiah. So what's interesting about the Isaac Luria's interpretation of Kabbalah is that what he basically prescribed was that you don't sit around and wait for the Messiah to come. You have to actively work for his coming. So this is why this Sabbatian tradition has always been millenarian. It's always about preparing the stage for the coming of the Messiah. The New Age movement is no different. You know, as anti-Christian or non-Christian as it's perceived to be, they are preparing for the coming of the Maitreya.
This is the dawning of the Age of Aquarius, right?
Right. You know, the Maitreya or, you know, Saint-Germain, they actually equate this, the Maitreya with Saint-Germain. And the singularity is no different because the singularity is supposedly the advent of artificial intelligence. It will be the time, the point in time at which we will have achieved the creation of artificial intelligence. And as we talked about last time, this is the Kabbalistic idea of creating a golem. So in other words, it's the Kabbalistic idea of creating the Messiah, creating the being that will be God. And I'm not speaking from the top of my head or my own interpretation. This is from their own words. We talked about Norbert Wiener's book last time. This is precisely, you know, we talked about Teilhard de Chardin and so on and so forth. That's how they see it. They see themselves as creating by creating artificial intelligence. They're creating a god. You know, what's important is this also goes back to Nietzsche. And Nietzsche and the idea of the Superman.
You know, well, and not only that, but with the transhumanism, you know, they can. Yeah. Oh, shoot. Well, I'll go back to that when we get back. All right.
Yeah.
Static girls erotic. Hug me, baby. Make it snappy. Everybody's oh so happy. Everybody's happy. There's no one pushing baby carriages. No one has to change.
All right. So transhumanism, you know, it basically computerizes and turns life into robots and then tells everybody they're going to be Superman. That's their whole pitch. And they want to, of course, create a genderless society because machines are genderless. And then eventually they want to get rid of life. They want to fool you. Oh, you know, you can upload your brain into the computer, you genius. You know, and then, you know, it's like, okay, so think about, you know, what happens if somebody just doesn't replace that hard drive 1 year? The power goes out or, you know, I was in IT for many years and there's all kinds of things. A virus comes in. There's all kinds of things that can happen to it. That's if your mind was really on the computer. But then, you know, once you're on the computer, there is no life. And they decide when it can be on and off, if it ever is again, you know. It's like, look, the dummy actually believed it. All they want to do is to create robots, and robots are not life. So this is the antithesis, the antithesis of what nature and God or life would be about. They're trying to eliminate that. Monsanto, the GMO foods, they want to patent nature so that they can own it. They want to insert and mess with all of the different DNA. Even though, no matter how much they pour chemicals into a bucket and mess with this stuff, there is still an original kernel of life there that they haven't figured out yet, hopefully. You know, but what they want to do is own everything that they can around that kernel of life. And it's that kernel of life that is so eluding. And, you know, and I guess if you wanted to call anything God, that would sort of be it, or, you know, or truth itself. But this is divine power. What's that?
They want divine power.
Yeah, they want divine power, exactly. And so everything is about flipping nature, natural law, God, you know, and I hate to use the word creationism, but, you know, however we got here, no matter how long you spend in your lifetime mixing chemicals in a bucket, one day life isn't going to come out of it, much less thousands or, you know, millions of different types of lives and insects and, you know, all of this stuff. But that's the religion created by Darwin, whose propaganda manager was ironically Thomas Henry Huxley, Julian and Aldous Huxley's grandfather, who, you know, we've been exposing every day. That's who wrote the psychopathic song that we use for the introduction and, you know, every break and everything else. But these are the same people that we're looking at selling all of this. So they're trying to flip everything upside down. And once you see it, once you see that they're trying to kill nature and God so that they can own life, own all aspects of life, from seed, from egg, from womb, all of it. They want to own it. They want to have artificial wombs. They want to create artificial insemination. They want to have the DNA, the controllability to be able to produce life itself so that they can get rid of all of you, and then they own you. How hard is that to get? And all of these people who think that Satanism is just, you know, ego worship and it's like Ayn Rand's objectivism. No, it's not. Objectivism is based on truth and reality. It's keeping consistent with reality. That's what objectivism is. Satanism, a cult, all of these knuckleheads, they use mysticism. Mysticism is the tool of tyrants for manipulating and controlling people, creating slavery, eliminating life itself so that they can be the satanic Luciferian masters of the world. I mean, people, wake up. You know, I get so sick and tired of these idiots, excuse me, who mail me, email me, etc., telling me that I'm wrong about Satanism. I just haven't studied it enough. And that, you know, and that it's really just like, you know, Ayn Rand's object. You know, you're just, you're taking care of yourself and your ego so that you can help others. It's not that at all. Wake up, people. Anyway, sorry for my rant there, man.
No, it's true. That's what it is. I mean, that's the thing is, those are low-level Satanists.
Yeah, well, I mean, those are, you know, those are the bottom-level Satanists. Those are the ones who are, I'm just curious in the occult. I'm just investigating. It's spiritual. Right. You know, it's like, hello, people, I went through studying all of that. I was an ethnobotanist for 20 years. I've been through all of that stuff. I've studied it, you know, and I'm coming out the other side. And here Dave and I are sitting here looking at each other's work, you know, and Hans's work too, and several other people. And we're all looking at the exact same names and people and stuff coming from entirely different points of view. How did we get there? Check the citations. Don't believe secondhand research. Trust your own five senses to bring you truth and to look up citations and things. It's when you believe what other people tell you. Just because David and I are on the radio and we have microphones, don't believe us. Check the damn citations. How many times do I have to say this? What does it take to get people to wake up and start actually checking things, and not just the secondary citation, check it all the way down to the primary until there's no further way to go. And you've gotten to the bottom, then you know what the original citation says. And if anyone tells you there is no truth, how the hell do they know that that's true? Have some brains to think about that for a second. Anyway, there's my rant. Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, it's good. Thanks.
I'll pass it over to you for a minute. I'm going to go off for another 10 minutes here. Okay. Anyway, go ahead. Where were we, David?
You know, something I wanted to mention was that one of the most important aspects, you know, you talked about the many strategies that they might use to undermine society.
Absolutely.
Their main strategy is cultivating anti-Semitism.
Interesting.
And I wrote an article about the Protocols of Zion, which is all the evidence that I've
brought forward to show of the circumstances of their emergence. I can go through that in a second, but what I'd like to first point out is to understand the basis of the plot of Orwell's 1984, who happens to have been a student of Aldous Huxley, of course.
Right, yep. How long does it take for us to get back to a Huxley?
Not very long.
Not very long.
Was it 3 degrees of separation? Or less?
Dude, I never get beyond 3 degrees, I don't think, when it comes. All roads lead to Huxley when it comes to MK Ultra, mind control, all of this crap that goes on. It all goes to Huxley.
Exactly. So 1984, what happens is that Winston is, he's astute. He's correctly suspicious that everything is not as it is. And somehow or another, his suspicions leads him to O'Brien. And O'Brien shows him the book. And the book, quote unquote, exposes the conspiracy, right? But does it or doesn't it? Because what happens is that the book is used to entrap him, right? Once O'Brien discovers that Winston is interested, thinks that he recognizes that the book is the truth, he's got him, and now he needs to deprogram him. And in the end, he finally deprograms him, and Winston is spit out back into society as a complete, basically, you know, empty shell.
Yeah, an automaton.
So conspiracy, this is really what I found in my last book. To what extent conspiracy culture is being manipulated. Conspiracy culture is one aspect, but an important component of conspiracy culture is the idea of a Jewish conspiracy. So,
but isn't looking at the Sebastian Jews as Satanists and seeing all of this, doesn't that connect that in?
To see, that's the key point, is distinguishing between Jews, a religion, and avoiding characterizing them as a race and lumping everybody.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, and you know, and I've tried to make that clear before that it's a religion and not a race. And I interviewed Professor Shlomo Sand years ago, although I think some of his research is questionable as well, but I didn't have time to go in and fact check it.
But that's how they've done it. So what I showed in my book is that, first of all, you know, as I mentioned, the important Sabbatian organizations were Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, and most important, the B'nai B'rith. So the B'nai B'rith was connected with the Order of Zion. And the Order of Zion was connected with Lord Palmerston, who was kind of the Alan Dulles of the previous century. With the Order of Zion, which was connected with the Alliance, the Israelite Alliance, the Universal Israelite Alliance. And so this Israelite Alliance was basically an outgrowth of the Rite of Memphis Mizraim. So when I mentioned earlier the importance of the Asiatic Brethren, it was behind the important trends of the late 19th century, which included the Golden Dawn, but also the Rites of Memphis Mizraim. What's important to understand as well, too, is that the OTO claimed basically to merge all these traditions into the OTO. So merging the OTO, the Martinists, the Memphis Mizraim, and so on, the Illuminati, and basically all the important organizations into the one. So Memphis Mizraim, this is why I show in my book this, it's the Memphis Mizraim basically it's a rite of Egyptian Freemasonry, which dates back to Count Cagliostro, who was a student of Samuel Falk that we mentioned earlier. So again, this is, you know, through and through a Kabbalistic, a Sabbatian Kabbalistic tradition. The person who was responsible for merging the two branches of Memphis and Mizraim into Memphis Mizraim was Garibaldi, who was with the Carbonari with Mazzini. These two guys are, again, essential in the late 1800s. So what's curious is that in, first of all, when after the protocols emerge, there's, of course, it creates immediate controversy. Most people, or a lot of people, believe them immediately to be true. And I'm not saying that they're not true in, to some certain, at least a significant degree, but the circumstances are very curious. So I can't remember what year it was. I think it was 1928 or so. The Times of London publishes an article which claims that the protocols are a forgery. The person who is responsible for cluing them to the supposed source.
You're not going
to
say Alan Dulles, are you?
Dulles, right? And so the book that was supposedly used as the source for the protocols was a book called, what was it called? It was by Maurice Joly, who Montesquieu and Machiavelli or something like that. So Maurice Joly was a protege, was also a Memphis Mizraim, and he was a protege of Adolphe Cremieux. Adolphe Cremieux was the Grand Master of Memphis Mizraim, as well as a member of the Order of Zion, which is part of this entire network, which is basically funded by, you know, really the most powerful Jewish banking families of the time. So I can't give you all the details because I can't remember off the top of my head. They're in my article.
I know the problem.
So the person who is suspected of having been responsible for writing the protocols was Pappus. His original name is Gerard Ancos. He was one of the most important occultists of the period. He was the Grand Master of the Martinists, which again leads back to Saint Martin, who was a follower of Samuel Falk and Jacob Burma, and so on and so forth. His leading student was René Guénon, who was a leading, very important occultist in the 20th century, founder of what's called traditionalism, of which Julius Evola is a key representative, which is the tradition of synarchism in our time. So Pappus is involved in a conspiracy in St. Petersburg at the turn of the late 1900s. What am I talking the right decades about? Sorry, late 1800s or early 1900s, around the person Nicholas II. There's a lot of people, a lot of occultists who are implicated. So you have Gurdjieff in there, you have Pappus, and Richard Spence has suspected that Aleister Crowley was involved in there too, indirectly of Blavatsky. And this is an entire network that was involved in suggesting that Nicholas II was the white czar of Buddhist legend and using the Shambhala myth to substantiate this sort of relationship between Tibet and Russia. And this is really the beginnings of the great game, and this is really what begins. It's at this time that Blavatsky makes her switch from revering Egypt to revering Tibet. And, you know, basically, you know, as they say, the rest is history at that point, because that's really what begins it all. This is the true origin of the Nazis' interest in Tibet, and then from there, the ongoing place of Tibetan Buddhism and the occult tradition, and the continuing relationship of the Dalai Lama, not only with the Nazis.
Your internet's with Nazis. Your internet was going haywire there for a second. Careful scratching whatever you're scratching there too. Go ahead. You still there?
Right. So, you can hear me?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll try again. So that explains the role that's the, you know, this is even before the current Dalai Lama, that it was his predecessor who was already sort of recruited to this conspiracy. The other guy involved there, his name was Lama Dorjiev, and so there's several claims that Lama Dorjiev was actually George Gurdjieff. So this is really the hub of this conspiracy, which really really begins, really, really gives birth to so much occultism in the 20th century. It revolves around papists, and it's in St. Petersburg, within that network, that papists then becomes responsible for supposedly providing the basis of what eventually became the protocols. Basically, you know, outlining or describing this elaborate Jewish conspiracy and so forth, that was very much like what was described in the protocols. But anyway, the person who provided the original protocols themselves to Nihlus was a woman named Juliana Glinka. She was an agent of George Rakovsky, who was the head of Russian intelligence in France. She was also a student of Blavatsky. Rakovsky himself was also connected to this entire network. He was working with Sergei Witte, who was Blavatsky's cousin, Okhtomsky, who was another guy who was visited by Blavatsky. He served as the model for what's his name, Prince Something, the main character in Gurdjieff's book In Search of Remarkable Men. So a tight network that involves all the leading characters, the leading figures of occultism in the 20th century, deriving right out of the tradition of Memphis Mizraim, is where the protocols came from.
You know, I wanted to add right there, several years ago, I tried to track down Alan Dulles's 1920 or 21 New York Times article where he writes about the protocols being a forgery. That particular day of the New York Times was missing. Everything else was there, but I couldn't find that particular article. I don't think I could find the whole paper for that day. But the story goes that Alan Dulles said it was a forgery. That doesn't mean, ladies and gentlemen, that the information therein is false. All it means is that the book itself was supposedly a forgery or not an original. So anyway, we'll be right back after this break.
In love and laughter, no remorse.
All right, we're back, and during the break, David and I were discussing how much of the protocols of Zion is a real thing versus, you know, and how much is deeper, whatever, what the real influence and impact has been, etc. So do you want to go into that, how much you think of that is real versus distraction, etc.?
Well, I think is exactly what Orwell described, right? It's the book. It's used to lure people out into lure dissidents out into the open. But most importantly, it was used by the Nazis basically grew out of Sabbatianism, and they used the protocols to turn the animosity of the Germans to the quote unquote the Jews, right? Making really the mistake that the ultimate mistake of anti-Semitism, of blaming the activities of an elite few on the mass majority of the people. And as I said earlier, they blame mostly Orthodox Jews. Like who was Hitler rounding up? He was rounding up, you know, shopkeepers and shoemakers, and, you know, when really the people who were actually funding him were the people who were supposedly exposed in the protocols, the Rockefellers and that entire network, the IG Farben, you know,
the higher level guys, essentially
Standard Oil, because they were orchestrating his mission. It's part of their dastardly plan, and this is how the protocols serve their Luciferian purpose. You know, this what's interesting is that the Nazi Party begins with the Thule Society, and the Thule Society was founded by Rudolf von Subutendorf. And Subutendorf, he studied in Turkey under the Sabbatians, who are known in Turkey as Domine. The Domine or Sabbatians in Turkey, they dominate Freemasonry, particularly in Salonika at the time. and they.
So what you're saying though is that these were basically Sebastian Jewish ideas, whether it came from Blavatsky or whatever they were, it was still ideas that came from a so-called Jewish faction. Is that correct?
Nazism was Jewish Kabbalah.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you look at the sources, it was Blavatsky and Edward Bulwer-Lytton. Those were the two primary theories. I mean, even then the idea of Thule itself is the idea of this Hyperborean continent, which is the origin of the Aryan people, right? Sort of like a pre-Atlantean or an Atlantean sort of, you know, homeland. The other idea, of course, is because from Bulwer-Lytton, they get the idea of the Vril from his book, The Coming Race. And this is the idea. This is what links it to Synarchism, because the coming race are this race of beings who live inside the hollow earth, and they master the power called the Vril. And this gave this was the basis for the Vril society that from which Nazism emerged as well. The person who was Karl Haushofer, who was a member, I suppose, leader of the Vril Society. And from the impression that I get, Haushofer was really Hitler's handler. So it's through Haushofer that you get now this connection to this idea of Agartha, which was, and Agartha is another version of Shambhala. It's two myths that are very closely connected. We talked about this, I think we talked about this last time, but Shambhala and Agartha were both suspected to be in the Altay Mountains of northwestern Mongolia. So again, this is the supposed location of the original shamanism. Again, this connects back to Blavatsky. So the Nazis are sending out expeditions to Tibet to supposedly seek out the source of Shambhala and Agartha and to meet with the representatives of Agartha. And this basically is what begins their relationship with the Nazis, and particularly the Dalai Lama. So, you know, what's the double curiosity here is that the idea of locating the source of the shamanism in the Altay Mountains is again a Sabbatian idea. We'll have to come back to that one.
All right, we'll be right back.
Lots to eat and hours for drinking. So more cocktails and no more thinking. No more thinking.
And we're back. And we have a caller on the line. Do you want to speak to Fred? I think he called in both on Wednesday and Monday when you were on as well.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to.
All right. Let's take Fred, Mike.
Hello. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we hear you, Fred. How you doing?
Hi, Fred.
Oh, you're a little bit confused. Anyhow, you guys are going to keep my butt working overtime for the next few months, at least, maybe a year. I'm getting old, so I count it in months. I don't want to go into exactly where I'm coming from. And any time I call in, I am not a hostile caller. I may disagree on some points, but it isn't with hostility. Anyhow, I label myself, and I ain't going to go into the explanation why I do label myself. I am a Christian Protestant, But Dave,
yeah,
like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, it seems like that would be stupid, idiotic, and foolish for them to publicize that. Now, Jan brought up John Foster Dulles, I think, and then
Alan Dulles,
a woman named Gloom or Glub or whatever. And I heard part of your explanation, but they were supposed to be found, and so therefore they were real. They whatever. But anyhow, it doesn't follow simple logic or sense for them
that they would popularize it or that they would let it out there, right? But let's look at this from another angle, Fred. It was Alan Dulles in 1920 in the New York Times who essentially, quote-unquote, debunked the protocols, thereby popularizing them in the New York Times in the first place. And then guys like Gordon Wasson, who used these same tactics, would do the, you know, Gordon Wasson would cry about, you know, creating the chaos in Huautla de Jimenez in Mexico regarding Maria Sabina and the magic mushrooms, and, you know, have crocodile tears while he was writing the article in the New York Times. So we have to also look at it and flip it the other direction. What advantage would it serve the future head of the CIA at that time to publicize that? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, who was then working to fund the Nazis.
Right, and, you know, and Alan Dulles was a lawyer for IG Farben, who was connected with Sandoz IG, who made the LSD, where Arthur Stolz, who probably was the real inventor of LSD, and Agent Albert Hoffman, who was French Intel and U.S. Intel, also worked. And then they were also working with, what's his name? The guy who created the Waldorf schools.
Steiner.
Steiner was working with Albert Hoffman and these guys in Switzerland at the time. And then we also know that LSD had to have been created between 1918 and 1933 because Leo Perutz publishes in St. Peter's Snow in 1933 about a drug created from weed or ergot that they used to create a communist rebellion in Vienna and Germany or Switzerland, whatever. And so, so we know that it has to be pre-1933. The official storyline is that Albert Hoffman invents LSD in 1938, discovers its psychoactivity in 1943. But if Arthur Stolz actually invented it sometime between 1918 and probably the early 1920s, in my opinion, then they would have actually had 20 additional years of human experimentation to do. And then they tossed the invention to Albert Hoffman in 1938 to cover up all of the previous experimentation that they were doing. And they know that we know now that ergot was used for warfare at least since the 16th century.
Well, I don't want to leave this conversation in another direction.
This is not...
I'm aware of H.G. Farben and what's the one that built the cannons in the 1600s or 1700s and so on, and even Ford's involvement with Hitler. But it was...
Hold on, Fred. Let Dave jump in. He wants to explain something real quick.
Yeah, I just want to say that it's not my theory that it comes from the horse's mouth, that it's Huxley's student George Orwell who gives us the clue of how it's used. I mean, that's exactly what the plot is of 1984, is of using a book that reveals the truth to capture dissidents.
Well, I got a hell of a lot of books to read now.
Do you get what he's saying, though? He's saying, you know, they put the book out there to find dissidents, to create and to find it, to find those people who would be most likely to dissent or to, excuse the pun there, protest, right?
Like you look in 1984.
I get that point. I'll sure agree with that. Whoever's doing it and whatever age, you know, to find out who the dissidents are, or otherwise who the enemies to whatever regime or whatever it is. I understand that. I want to make a statement. You know, I want to get proficient or conversant or knowledgeable about apologetics, and that's going to just one hell of a lot of work. Plus, what all the information I'm getting from you and your show and Dave and the other two people you mentioned, in other words, a hell of a lot of work. Okay, I'm I'm not going to take any more time this evening. But
all right, Fred.
Keep on, boys.
All right, thanks.
Thank
Have a good
so
night.
Much, Fred.
What do you want to add to that, Dave?
Yeah.
Oh, I lost you there. Are you still there? Hello? Uh-oh. We just lost David. I heard him click something, maybe. David, you there? Can you call him back in? All right, I don't know what happened there. So anyway, what Dave was trying to explain is that George Orwell's book, 1984, is about, you know, this guy Winston. What they do is they put their own dissident book out there into the public to find people who might wake up. And of course, Winston finds the book. He goes to the, you know, the shop owner's store, and they have the bed there and everything. And but he buys the book. He buys, I think, a notepad also, and he meets this woman at this this shop, and they have this little private room upstairs. And then you find that the whole thing is set up. So the point is that the protocols could be one of these things that they're using. And in Dave's opinion, it is one of these things that they're using in order to, yeah, no problem, in order to catch people who would be dissenters. So it does make sense. Again, we have to separate the issue of Sebastian, Hasidic Judaism, Reform Judaism, I would imagine, also from, you know, good Jews who, you know, aren't the type who want to manipulate and lie to people and use the Kabbalah. And, you know, another issue is from the Jews' own mythology, from the Bible anyway, they are all the children of Cain. And so, you know, that it kind of follows that they would almost be a, you know, if their story branches off from the, you know, Adam and Eve's child that did evil. What does that say that the religion, at least the Sebastian form, the Kabbalic form, which flips everything upside down, that would suggest to me anyway, its core, you know, its kernel of it, you know, the origin of it. Dave?
Yeah.
Anything to add to that or correct?
Well, that's kind of the origin of the Aryan race theory. Right? That's the idea is that the descendants of, and this is why it's the paradox that the Aryan race theory comes from Jewish Kabbalah, and Swedenborg is why Swedenborg is the key to understanding how that happens. You know, what I wanted to mention as well is that an important source for the Aryan idea and Subutendorf's Thule Society was Pan-Turkism. So as I said, he Subutendorf went to study with the Domine Turks or Sabbatian Jews of Turkey, and he absorbed ideas that were Pan-Turkish because he was connected. The Sabbatians of Turkey dominated what's called the Young Turk movement. So, and they followed an idea called Pan-Turkism. The Pan-Turkism begins with a man called Kosoma de Koros, who is a Hungarian, a Hungarian scholar, who from about 50 years before, he was the source that introduced Blavatsky to the idea of Shambhala. And so Pan-Turkism is based on the idea, because this comes from Biktashi Sufism. The Biktashi pretend to be Sufis, basically Islamic Sufis, but they were actually antinomian, you know, Gnostic, anti-Islamic, an anti-Islamic sect, who they believed that the true religion of the Turkish people was Central Asian shamanism, particularly the shamanism of the Altay Mountains. So this is where basically Blavatsky gets her idea.
And then Wasson and on down the line.
So again, it's a Sabbatian idea. So of course it's it becomes a core.
So what you're saying in a roundabout way is that countries like Iran are actually named after a Kabbalah term because Iran is Aryan.
Well, indirectly. So Iran, you're right, means is because the modern scholars, when they invented the idea of the Aryan race, they were borrowing from Kabbalistic theories, the idea that the descendants of Cain, the sons of God of the Bible, who were the fallen angels, interbred with the female descendants of Cain, and that's how they produced the Nephilim. And so then what they claim that this story refers to is the creation of the Aryan race on Atlantis. So when Atlantis sank or was destroyed in the flood, they escaped to the mountains of Asia. And from there, they spread to various parts of the world, particularly to the Altai Mountains. And that's why shamanism is a relic or heritage of the Aryan race. So in the late 18th century, when these occult influenced scholars started to fabricate the theory of the Aryan race, which is also referred to as the Indo-European people, they claimed that the Aryans were the origin of the Europeans and the Indians and the Persians. And they borrowed the term from Herodotus, who referred to them as Aryans, which is basically also a term, I think it's in the Vedas or something like that. So it's indirect. So it's more the European occultists hijacking the term for their own purposes. Because yes, it's true, the Iranians have always referred to the Aryans, but not in the sense that the occultists were using them. Well, you know, what's really paradoxical is that the Aryans are descended from the Medes. And the Medes were descended from Colchis. Colchis, in ancient times, was located in what's today called Georgia. So it's just basically, I think it's on the north side of the Caucasus Mountains. But according to Herodotus, the Colchians were an exceptional, not that much of an exception, actually. He came up with a theory that the Colchians were an Egyptian colony, and the reason was because they were black skin and had woolly hair and practiced circumcision, just like the quote-unquote Phoenicians. And he also had the theory they came from a quote-unquote Egyptian colony. So it's very curious. So the fact that he would say that the Phoenicians were Egyptian basically and practiced circumcision is because Herodotus was referring to Jewish people. This was a time in history when the world wasn't aware of a Jewish people, because they basically weren't aware of the Jewish religion. They just knew them as Phoenicians. So the fact that he would refer to a similar colony in Georgia suggests that this was basically a people, if they came from Egypt, that they were also descendants of Israelites. So I go through a lot of this in my book, Black Terror, White Soldiers. It's all connected to the idea of Gog and Magog, because these are stories that are behind the idea of the spread of the lost tribes of Israel. The lost tribes of Israel, when they were scattered, they basically mixed with the Medes. And from there into India, and this is why to this day, there's claims of descendants of the lost tribes living particularly in Afghanistan, but it has traditionally been understood in Jewish culture that the lost tribes were lost into Central Asia, so that the people of Central Asia, primarily the Turkish people, were modern descendants of the lost tribes. So the fact that they would connect the Altai Mountains as the source of the Aryan race is basically just kind of a turning upside down the whole story of the lost tribes and Gog and Magog and all that stuff. And that's what really ultimately contributes to the theories of the Nazis and then transhumanism.
Oh boy, that's a long trek, you know. And I'm still—I'll admit, David, I'm still reading your book, Black Terror, White Soldiers. I got into writing like five or six articles I think what happened was I was sitting down reading your book one night, and I saw a citation, and I went to go track down the primary, and I ended up, you know, following that up for like a week after.
I hear you. That's what it's like.
Sounds it was that the bumper music I heard?
It's coming.
Oh, 20 seconds. All right. So anyway, it's like sometimes I hear it, sometimes I don't, and I'll just keep talking right through it. So anyway, I'm reading Secret Agent 666 about Aleister Crowley, and I've got your book sitting here, and I'll start reading. It's already like got probably 40 or 50 flags in it.
Right.
But anyway, we'll be back in a few moments, and we'll have a few minutes after the break to wrap up. All right, we're back, and we've got a few minutes left. Dave, did you want to take a call before we wrap it up?
Yeah, sure, that'd be great.
All right, let's go to Dave in Nevada. Dave, you there?
Hi, guys. I just heard you guys talking about the protocols a few minutes ago. And I was reading somewhere that there's an actual that the original document was actually written in French, and the word Zion isn't really Zion. It's spelled with an S, as in Sion, and the theory goes that it's in reference to the Priory of Sion, and it's not really having anything to do with Zionism.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the organization that was responsible for ultimately revealing the protocols, the original source of the protocols was a book by Maurice Joly, and his mentor was Adolphe Cremieux, who was a member of the Order of Zion. So I think to argue that away is... You know, the problem is that the protocols make a lot of people very uncomfortable, obviously, right? Because it seems to mirror what's happening. It identifies Jews as the culprits, and so it puts people in a predicament. You know, so a lot of people who would like to admit a portion of it, they need to try to kind of find a way to work their way away from anti-Semitic accusations. So it's a tricky one. So I think that's what happens.
And the issue is identifying those who are Sebastians and Hasidic, et cetera, Jews who actually do those things. Well, essentially, you don't create a guilt by association fallacy. You go person by person, right?
That's right. And that's why it's used, right? That's the MO. That's the idea is create, using the protocols to create that association, the false association, because that kind of anti-Semitism is the kind, right up until today, which is used to justify support for Israel. They need to create the impression of worldwide anti-Semitism. That's the job of the ADL, which is a product of the B'nai B'rith, which is a Sabbatean organization.
And Abe Foxman is CIA as well.
I highly recommend a documentary.
A
documentary online about anti-Semitism. I can't remember the name, but it's an Israeli documentary filmmaker. It's excellent. And he interviews Abe Foxman, and Abe Foxman...
Oh, I have that, yes.
Yes. He admits that you need to fight the conspiracy by using the conspiracy. That's his own words. They need to maintain the illusion of this, immense threat of power and control, because that's how they manage their own program. That's how they manage to recruit the support of the U.S. at the tune of how many billions of dollars a year are sent to Israel, and this constant, and how they manage to get away literally with murder every day in Palestine.
Sure, and not only that, but they put a secret tax on everybody's food in the grocery store. All of the kosher taxes goes to fund Israel, et cetera, and that's all. It's less than 0.7 to 3% of the population get to charge a food tax on the other 97%+ and send that money off.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg, because, you know, Zionism controls CIA, controls Hollywood, controls New York Times, controls the university system. I mean, you know, our... Yeah.
David, real quick, your website.
Thank you. Conspiracyschool.com.
All right. And ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap. Sorry I had to cut you off there, Dave, but we're at the end right now. And ladies and gentlemen, good night. GnosticMedia.com. Please support the show while you're there. Good night. Drinking, so my cocktails and no more thinking.